You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Sturgeon Bay has become the latest Ice Age trail community. We'll find out what that means and what impact it could have on the area. Now, in the days and weeks leading up to the fall election, many polls had Joe Biden with a comfortable lead over President Trump. A Washington Post poll had Biden with a 17-point lead in Wisconsin. That one was widely seen as an outlier. But the final Marquette University Law School poll had Biden with about a 5-point edge. He wound up winning by less than 1 point. CNN had Biden up by 12 points nationally. He won by about 3. All this came after pollsters undercounted Trump's support, apparently in 2016 as well. Republican pollster Frank Luntz was on Fox News over the weekend. He says it's time for the polling industry to face the music.
This should be a loss of credibility. If you can't get it right, if you can't make an accurate prognosis, you shouldn't be hired. So I think what's happening right now is actually awesome. It's accountability in action. And if you got it wrong this time, you got it wrong twice in a row, you should be working in the business. There's other things you can sell real estate, you can sell stocks, stop selling polls.
Our next guest says polls are, quote, on the emergency room table. You can join us at 800-642-1234. What do you make of the polls getting it wrong? Do you tend to trust polling, or have you always taken it with a grain of salt? Has your opinion of polling changed over the last few years? Do you answer the phones when a poll calls? Do you even know it's a poll? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Charles Franklin is a professor of law and public policy and director of the Marquette University Law School poll. Charles, welcome back to the show.
Good to be here.
Well, can you talk, Charles, about changes that you and other pollsters made between 2016 and 2020 to try to fine-tune the polling?
Sure. And some of those work to some extent, but as you were just saying, the average error is pretty large. I'll give you an example. In our 2016 poll, we were on Clinton's vote within a decimal point of her actual vote, but we understated Trump's margin by about 8 percentage points. So that was a huge error for us and also led us to have Clinton ahead when obviously Trump won. This year, with the changes that we made, we were off by 3 points on a high voter turnout model and by 4 points on our usual turnout model. But this time we had Biden at 50 and he got 49.6. So again, very close to Biden's vote. But on Trump's vote, even with our changes, we had him at 45 and he's getting 48.9. So again, this time we're 3.9 points off. So about half the error that we had last time, but still an understatement of Trump's vote. Now, this time we did correctly have Biden leading, and we consistently through the fall had Biden ahead by either 4 or 5 points and characterized that as a modest but steady lead. We also saw a group of polls in the state that had Biden up by 8, 9, 10, 11 points. And I think, first of all, that raised the average poll in the state and means that the average poll is off by 8 or 9 points. So there's some variation in how big the error is. But I think those larger leads tended to dominate the impressions that were formed about the campaign. And that's not just true here. It was true in many states, at least on a preliminary basis. And granted, the full votes are not tallied yet. But it looks like something just a little under a 6-point exaggeration of Biden's lead is the average error in state polling around the country. And that's higher than it was last time and is certainly a reason to be concerned about what was it that led to this consistent overestimate of Biden's advantage.
Now, I want to talk about margin of error with you a little bit. I believe the margins of error in your last poll was in the neighborhood of 4%. And correct me if I'm wrong. That means that you say Biden's getting 50, I'm just going to round it to 50.
Yeah, that's
he could range from 46 to 54. And Trump, if he's getting 45, could range from, 41 to 49. So within that, there was an opportunity for a Trump victory still consistent with the polling. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's right. And our actual margin of error was 4.4, but I agree, let's keep it simple so you and I both can do this in our heads. But that's exactly right. And so a 4 or 5 point lead with a 4 point margin of error means it's probable that the leading candidate's ahead, but it's not a guarantee. And I think, you know, we report the margin of error with every poll. Reporters, the news, public radio report that margin of error, but it's hard for us to find a way to convey that uncertainty. And I think it's so much easier to simply say Biden's ahead by five than it is to say Biden's ahead by five with a plus or minus 4 point margin of error. That's complicated to get across. And, you know, you state it once in the press release or in the coverage, but it's tiresome to repeat it every single time.
Talking to Charles Franklin from the Marquette University Law School poll, talking about polling and the 2020 election. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Okay, all that said, you were saying there's a pretty general trend in 2016, maybe a little less so, but still there in 2020, of undercounting Trump voters in the polls. What are some of the ideas of why that ended up that way?
Yeah, I think that there's now, with this additional election, pretty strong evidence that there's a modest group. I don't want to exaggerate the size of this, right? We were off on Trump's vote by 3.9%. So let's say there's maybe 4% of the public that supports President Trump, but declines to participate in polling altogether. This is different from the shy Trump notion that people are just unwilling to say, but rather simply withdrawing from participation in the public conversation that polling is trying to provide. I and my fellow pollsters have looked for those people and not found them, but I think, again, we see the evidence that they're missing, and they're missing from our surveys.
I've seen an argument, Charles, that a lot of people these days just don't answer the phone from a phone number they don't recognize. And you try to account for that, of course, in polling, but the numbers are so big that if, say, a Democratic voter is more willing to pick up that phone than a Republican voter for whatever reason, I don't know what the reason would be, but right, if there, that is skewed in any way, that could be skewing the polls. What do you think?
That's right. Certainly, lots of people don't pick up the call, but it has always been that Democrats and Republicans alike despise scam and telemarketing calls. And so there hasn't been a partisan balance bias in this. Also, if you look at our data over the last 4 years, we have consistently had about a 45% Republican, 45% Democratic split. And that has not trended or changed over the last few years, meaning we are not losing Republican respondents, say, or gaining Democratic respondents. That's been very flat. But that doesn't fully account for the idea that there might be this 3 or 4 or 5% that we are missing entirely, who are not necessarily Republicans, but are supporters of President Trump and turn out for him in elections, but don't do the polls. One reason that's an attractive idea is that in 2018, with President Trump not on the ballot, we were within 1.1 points of the governor's race and a tenth of a point in the Senate race. And this spring, in the presidential primary for the Democrats, we were within two of Biden and of Sanders. What's the difference between those three elections that were very accurately estimated and this one, when we're off by 3 or 4, let alone 2016, when we were off by 8, a really bad performance? You know, one obvious thing is it's the president's presence on the ballot and this idea that he brings a set of voters in who are very skeptical of polls, of media, very supportive of him, but may not be regular voters in midterm elections.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Jeremy is with us in Wausau. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. My points, he actually just kind of brought up one of my points in that, you know, a lot of people might not normally vote that are now going out because of, like, how polarizing this issue is. And I think just the level of importance people, everyday people, are putting on polls and how they expect it to be so accurate is, in one, and it's a mistake, and in two, it can actually help rev up even more support for the losing party.
Oh, interesting, Jeremy. A couple interesting points there, Charles. One, I guess, sure. What should everyday people do when they see a poll? And two, do polls, you know, I guess it's an uncertainty principle. Does observing these things in polls change voter behavior?
Right. I think one thing that we're certainly going to look for, and Jeremy's right on it, is there a turnout difference that we can find? Let's look, and we won't be able to do this until after the results are certified and we're sure about the counts everywhere. But is there a chance that turnout either exceeded expectations or perhaps fell short of expectations in various parts of the state? I think that, aside from the story of Trump supporters who are reluctant to do the polls, is another possibility. And that would be a surge in Election Day turnout in the strongest areas of the state for President Trump. As for, you know, the way that polls are presented and the way people perceive them, and I think polling averages and forecasting models are part of this, tends to focus on that margin. Somebody's up by 5 or somebody's up by 8 or whatever that is. And again, we're not conveying the sort of uncertainty about that. And, you know, finally, after 2 substantial errors in a row, maybe that will indeed lead people to be a lot more skeptical about the numbers they see, and paradoxically, thus actually appreciate the margin of error a little bit better.
Thanks for that call. We're talking about the state of political polling after many polls were again off on the presidential race. Charles Franklin is with us, director of the Marquette University Law School Survey. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been following the polls in the run-up to the presidential race? What did you make of them? Do you have questions about how it works? Concerns about how they work and can go wrong? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now we're looking at the polls, what they got wrong in the presidential race in 2020, and the future of the polling industry. Charles Franklin's with us, professor of law and public policy and director of the Marquette University Law School poll. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Platteville. Jim, hi.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are beginning to believe that some pollsters may have an agenda, especially when they're off double digits, that their agenda is to try and discourage the voters of a candidate they're not in favor of. And we don't really know who won yet. We have these Dominion voting machines that were off by 6,000 votes or more in one county. And there's 46 other counties in the same state using the same system.
I'll cut in there, Jim. There's a lot of fact checks on that particular claim. But to Jim's main point, Charles, Jim's skeptical that pollsters may have an agenda or a bias.
Yeah, I think that that is a common perception, especially President Trump has emphasized that in talking about fake polls. And this is part of the complication of where we are is that every president has always criticized polls that they don't like. But in the last few years, this has become a strongly partisan perception and one that the president has emphasized. And then when the polls are also off and off in favor of the Democrat, I think that reinforces that perception. So I don't think that I don't believe that professional pollsters, especially those that are not working for a campaign, I don't think that they have any real incentive to be wrong. You had the bit from Frank Lutz at the top of the show saying, if you can't get this right, you should get out of the business. I think that we diminish our credibility every time we're wrong, and that's a big deal. So the idea that we would purposely be wrong, I think, is stretching it a bit. But the reasons why we were as wrong as we were, and why some were a lot wrong and some a bit wrong, those are things that we really have to work on. And, you know, we've worked on them for 4 years and we've still not solved the problem. That's a big deal.
Thanks for that call. I'm looking at an article here. This is in The Atlantic, Charles, about how Gallup polls are trying to figure out how they got the incumbent president so wrong, underestimated his chances of winning. The year is 2012, and the president was Barack Obama. The polling error doesn't always go one partisan way or the other, does it? Obama, I think the general consensus was, outperformed some of the big polls at the time.
No, that's right. And it is an important point that over, let's say, the last 20 years since 2000, we see polling errors go in a pro-Democratic direction, sometimes a pro-Republican direction the next. And when you look at individual pollsters, they're not consistent from year to year in terms of whether they're too high or too low. In one sense, that's what we would expect from random sampling. We would expect variation. On the other hand, the biases now have been modest in most cases in 2016, but big in Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania in 2016. This year, they look pretty big, but not always gigantic in 2020. For example, in Georgia, it looks like the average error is about 1 percentage point. So very small error in some places. But as I said earlier, averaging about 6% this time and persistently in a Democratic direction.
Time for another caller now. David is with us in Oconomowoc. David, hi.
Hi there. I was just wondering, how accurate are the exit polls?
Well, that's an interesting question, David. And we heard from Sue on Facebook, who says, after the election, how do they know I'm a white woman, let alone who I voted for? Charles, we're seeing all these post-election analyses saying what demographic groups broke for which. Are exit polls any better than other polls, especially given that so many people didn't walk up to a poll to vote?
Right. I think exit polls are complicated, and there's a lot of, within the profession, understanding of the fallibility of exit polls. I think this is a big problem that exit polls for a long time, this is not this year, but going back to at least 2004, if not before that, we reify the idea that exit polls are super accurate when in fact they're not super accurate. And that's a real problem, to treat them as an infallible arbiter. What they're useful for and have historically been used for is to understand how different groups voted, who voted for whom, and why they did that. But they're not useful for forecasting the outcome of an election. And that's true of this year as much as any year.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Kelsey with us now in Janesville. Kelsey, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if we could theoretically, hypothetically discuss what a United States would look like without polls. Certainly wouldn't want to suppress any freedoms of the press, but how would that change, you know, how candidates interacted with us and their campaign strategies? And without any, you know, personal offense to your guests, would our country be better off without so much dependence on polls?
Very politely asked, Kelsey. Great, Charles, what do you think?
Great question, and seriously, I'm absolutely not offended by it. Thank you for posing it. Here's my take on this. If we didn't have public polling, then it would only be the campaigns and the parties and the interest groups that do the polling, and there wouldn't be an independent look at polling, whether from the media or from universities. Now, you know, if hypothetically you could ban polling altogether, would it be, in fact, better to run elections without knowing what the public thinks, or better to be informed by what the public thinks? So obviously, I'm a homer here. I like polls, and I think their purpose of informing the public is like the purpose of a free press in trying to provide independent information. But you know, we are fallible and there are problems with that. But I do think if you're going to have polling at all, it shouldn't be limited only to the interest groups and the parties and the candidates who have a very strong self-interest in those results, but should be something that also contains a public sphere of polling.
Thanks a lot for that call. In our last minute or so, Charles, I saw some outfit in California said, hey, we got better results when we asked not just who are you going to vote for, but who do you think people around you are going to vote for? You know, maybe it was coincidence that that one worked out better. What do you think about asking questions in a different way to tease out who people are going to vote for?
I'm fine with trying out different questions. I must say I followed that one. It seems very ad hoc to me. And was a good way for that particular poll, which had Biden up by 10 or 11, to then have it the other way as well by saying, but there were other questions that showed a close race. So, no, count me unimpressed with that. But strongly encouraging the idea that we tried different methodologies, including online polling, including text message-based polling, including phone polls like we do. All of those things are active areas of research, and if we can find ways to do better, we're all better off as a polling industry, as well as a consuming public, to get the best possible methods. So there's a lot of experimentation going on in alternative ways, but I'm unimpressed with that particular question.
Charles, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Charles Franklin's a professor of law and public policy and director of the Marquette University Law School poll. We talked to him about the future of political polling after many polls, again, were off on the presidential race. Coming up, we learn what it means that Sturgeon Bay is now designated as an official Ice Age Trail community. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Wisconsin Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is calling for a review of the state's election last week. We'll talk about why he's asking for the investigation and look at the reaction it's getting. Now, the 1,200-mile Ice Age Trail in Wisconsin has seen a lot of traffic this year. It's the 40th anniversary of its designation as one of America's national scenic trails. Going east, the trail ends in Sturgeon Bay, which was just designated an official community by the Ice Age Trail Alliance. Kevin Quinn is an Ice Age Trail Alliance trail steward and Sturgeon Bay Ice Age Trail Committee co-chair and lead volunteer. Kevin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks a lot. Happy to be on.
What does it mean to be an official Ice Age Trail community?
Well, I think it's a recognition of Sturgeon Bay's sort of special place as a terminal location for one of the terminals of the Ice Age Trail. You know, it's a place where people come to begin or end a thru-hike journey who, for example, are attempting to do the whole trail. And in addition, I think it's a recognition of the importance of the Ice Age Trail, you know, especially this year with people wanting to get out and enjoy the outdoors in the midst of the pandemic, that the Ice Age Trail is a place for people to be able to do that and start experiencing some of the outdoors and the unique experiences that the Ice Age Trail provide hikers.
Now you, I understand, have hiked the entire trail. Tell us some about what you love about this this big part of Wisconsin scenery.
Well, it was both sort of a social experience and a learning experience, an educational experience about how the Ice Age actually transforms the landscape of Wisconsin. A social experience because, you know, when you're out on the trail for that period of time, for as long as it takes you to walk the 1,200 miles, you get to interact with people in towns and along the roads, and you get to really experience all the different areas of Wisconsin from the eastern terminus here in Sturgeon Bay down to, you know, through Manitowoc and Janesville and then up into the central and western parts of the state. You go through a lot of small towns on the trail. You get to talk to a lot of different people. And in walking the trail, you get to see a lot of how the last glacier period actually shaped the landscape. And until you're walking it, you don't have exactly the same experience or appreciation of it as you do when you're, maybe just driving by.
And set the scene for us for the trail as it comes into Sturgeon Bay. What do we see there?
So the Sturgeon Bay segment actually begins near the town of Maplewood, and you're on for a while an old rail-to-trail network called the Anapi Trail. And then one of the unique features of the Sturgeon Bay segment is then you actually walk through the West Side Business District down Madison Avenue, and then it eventually gets you to the park entrance to Pottawatomie State Park. And so for the last 3 miles, you walk through the park and you get to walk along the shore of Sturgeon Bay, have great views of the shipyard and the bay itself. And then you walk up the bluff to get to the terminus, which is right where the old Pottawatomie Observation Tower is located. So it really gives you a cross section of the different kinds of terrain, and the last bit puts you onto the Niagara Escarpment, which is one of the geological features in eastern Wisconsin, and actually spreads all the way across the United States to the New York Niagara Falls area and beyond.
Now, you've got this Ice Age Trail community designation. Can you talk about the Ice Age Trail and the thing it connects to as part of the identity of your community in Sturgeon Bay?
So the trail community designation actually sort of represents kind of a symbiotic relationship, if you want to call it that, between the Ice Age Trail Alliance and the community itself. The Alliance is interested in developing these relationships with the communities to sort of encourage and enhance the ability of people to get out and experience the trail. But it's also very much kind of an economic engine, because we've seen this tremendous growth and interest in hiking the trail in recent years, and especially this year. And so it benefits the community for this kind of designation and acknowledgement to be made on the Ice Age Trail Association's website, for example. It brings people into the community. The trail community designation allows for a notification through the Alliance website of the kind of things that the community can offer hikers when they're coming through. A big part of what the Alliance is trying to do with the Ice Age Trail is provide sort of an educational opportunity for hikers. I mean, it tells a story about the effects of climate change, for example. The trail is inspired by, and the map of the trail traces the terminal moraine of the furthest extent of the glaciers into Wisconsin during the last ice age, which began to end about 20,000 years ago. So it's a really nice educational opportunity on top of providing hikers with, a great experience of being in the outdoors.
And Kevin, as we wrap up, can you give a little encouragement for people to head over to the nearest link in the Ice Age Trail to their community?
Yes. I mean, I think, it's not just people who walk the Ice Age Trail that want to walk all 1,200 miles all in one shot. By far, the most activity that the trail gets in terms of hikers is people going out for a day or a few hours to enjoy the trail. There's a lot of information about how you can select that. And because of where the trail goes, I mean, for a lot of people in Wisconsin, you're not going to be very far from either a trail community or even the trail itself. So I'd really encourage people to just go to the website and find where the trail is close to where you live and consider getting out there for doing a little bit of a walk.
Kevin, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Hey, thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Kevin Quinn is an Ice Age Trail Alliance trail steward and Sturgeon Bay Ice Age Trail Committee co-chair and lead volunteer. Right now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the answer to a Why Wisconsin question about wildfires here in the state.
2020 has seen record wildfires in the western United States. It prompted this listener question as part of our Wisconsin project. Why doesn't Wisconsin see the same large, intense wildfires? In reality, Wisconsin has not been immune from major wildfires. Andrea Anderson has more on the differences and the state's wildfire history.
The western U.S. experienced one of the worst wildfire seasons in 2020. It left thousands of people homeless, including Jerry Vavra of Oregon, who spoke with NPR.
We had no time. We didn't even get any of our valuables or anything. We lost everything. It looked like we were actually in hell, really.
Catherine Cooley is a wildlife prevention specialist with the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources. She was one of 60 state DNR forestry staff who helped fight wildfires in western states in 2020. Cooley says there's no comparison when it comes to fire conditions out west with those in Wisconsin.
In the west, the fuels, the vegetation type, the density of the fuels, the moisture content, weather patterns, topography, and even the fire causes are significantly different than what we see. The vast majority of those fires are caused by lightning events, where they have lightning and then they aren't followed up by rain. You know, typically in Wisconsin, when we have lightning, we see rain. We have a lot of very green, lush vegetation.
While the 2020 wildfire season in the western U.S. has killed dozens of people, destroyed hundreds of structures, and burned millions of acres, Wisconsin had more than 600 wildfires. They were smaller fires that damaged a little more than an acre apiece on average. But that doesn't mean Wisconsin has never had a giant wildfire.
We turn now to the North Woods, where firefighters are still dealing with the last remnants of the largest wildfire Wisconsin has seen in the last three decades. The fire
a lot of it was a little bit unexpected because we had 23 inches of snow 10 days prior to that fire.
Eric Martin is a DNR forest fire suppression specialist. He was an incident commander for the Gurman Road Fire, which burned about 7,500 acres and destroyed 23 homes in Bayfield and Douglas counties in May of 2013. It took firefighters from dozens of departments more than a day to extinguish the fire that was determined to be started unintentionally by a logging company working in the area.
Gurman wasn't exactly the biggest fire that I've ever been on. It wasn't exactly the worst, so to speak, fire, though it was very bad for the folks that it affected.
The deadliest wildfire in Wisconsin and U.S. history was the Peshtigo Fire in October of 1871. 1,200 people, including 800 in Peshtigo, died in the fire that tore through 1.2 million acres of land. Martin says the Peshtigo Fire is still a teaching tool and a reason National Fire Prevention Month is held in October.
We talk about it in terms of historic fire and what could happen. We talk about it in terms of land management and land use. You know, keep in mind, in 1871, they had a historically dry summer that led into their fall fire season.
Cooley says the vast majority of Wisconsin wildfires can be avoided.
98% of our fires are caused by people, therefore they don't have to happen. And the way to prevent those is by knowing what that fire danger is, getting burning permits before you burn a debris pile, checking the landscape around your campfire, if you're operating equipment, whether it be an ATV that might throw some sparks or your chains from your boat trailer as you're heading up to your cabin, you know, anything like that can cause a spark. And if it's dry out and if it's in the right place at the right time, it can cause a wildfire for sure.
The DNR also recommends the safest time to burn debris piles is when the ground is completely snow covered.
That was WPR's Andrea Anderson with a story on wildfires in Wisconsin. WPR's John Davis produced the feature. They answered an audience question as part of the Wisconsin Project. Submit your question and we might answer it in a future Wisconsin Live segment. Go to WPR.org/Wisconsin. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Coming up, Wisconsin's Assembly Speaker is calling for lawmakers to investigate the state's election. We'll find out why and what reaction it's gotten. That's coming up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, join the conversation about different demographic groups in the United States and how they voted last week. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, Wisconsin's Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss is calling for an investigation into how the state's election was handled. On Friday, Voss directed the Assembly Committee on Elections to investigate the election operations. His request comes as President Trump and other Republicans claim that widespread voter fraud is responsible for giving Joe Biden a victory, despite a lack of evidence. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
Well, what are we hearing from Speaker Voss?
So Speaker Voss put out this statement on Friday afternoon, and he said that he hopes that the committee, the elections committee, investigates, quote, the inefficiency of Milwaukee's central counting of absentee ballots, as well as the removal of voters from the rolls who no longer live there. That was about as specific, that was as specific as he got in his press release. He didn't mention any other specific instances of voter fraud that he wanted the committee to look into.
Now, the inefficiencies of Milwaukee's vote count, you mentioned Milwaukee counted, well, you and I know we were up on election night. Milwaukee counted late into the wee hours of the morning. That's in part because they got a lot of mail-in ballots and state law didn't allow them to start counting early, right?
Absolutely. So Wisconsin state law doesn't allow the counting or the processing of absentee ballots until polls open on election day. A number of other states allow election workers to do things like open the ballots, you know, smooth them out, just kind of do those early stages before they feed them into the machines. It sounds silly that it takes a while to do those things for absentee ballots, but when you're talking about tens of thousands of ballots that you can't begin processing until 7 a.m. on election day, the time just kind of stacks up. And there are a variety of things that have to be done to the ballots. You've got to check them for different requirements. They've got to be checked against the poll book. Like I said, taken out of the envelope, smoothed out, fed into the machine. If you've ever experienced a paper jam, when you've fed paper into your printer, that can happen with the ballots. If that happens, they have to go through a time-consuming process dictated under state law about how to recreate that ballot, with a number of people observing. So it's a time-consuming process. And election officials told us for several weeks ahead of election day that they expected it to go late into the night on election night or into the next morning as it did.
What's been the reaction to the speaker's call from various interested parties?
So the chair of the Elections Commission in the Elections Committee, rather, in the Assembly is Republican Representative Ron Tussler. He said that he's going to move forward with the speaker's request. He's hoping to have the committee meet soon and start issuing subpoenas. The committee has subpoena power to get information about the elections. Tussler said in an interview with WisPolitics that he believes this is about transparency. He said that he believes that there are a lot of folks across the state who think the election or who thought the election was going to go one way. It went a different way. He said, and this is a quote, he said, "We just want people to understand whether their candidate won or lost, it was a valid and fair election." So GOP chair of the committee there kind of talking about what he thinks the purpose is. Meanwhile, Democratic state lawmakers have been pretty sharply critical of the speaker's call for this investigation.
Talk to Laurel White, WPR state capitol reporter, about Assembly Speaker Robin Voss's call for an investigation of Wisconsin's election. And now we have this in a release today from Republican Representative Joe Sanfilippo. So he raises some issues. We can get into those in a bit. But quoting here, "If an investigation shows these actions affected the outcome of the election, we need to either declare this past election null and void and hold a new election or require our Electoral College delegates to correct the injustice with their votes," end quote. Are a lot of Republicans talking about the possibility of overturning the result of the state election?
I haven't heard of any other Republican state lawmakers other than Representative Sanfilippo making that kind of statement.
What are some of the concerns that he raised? And these are some that you mentioned with Speaker Voss. The idea, and this has been a big topic of conversation, these voters who are supposed to be removed from the rolls, according to one order, it was making its way through the courts. What ended up happening with that?
So this is a case that we've been following for a long time at WPR. It's a case that actually went before the state Supreme Court in late September. The court has yet to issue a ruling in the case. essentially what it comes down to is allegations that the Wisconsin Elections Commission hasn't been following state law for a time frame in which people who may have moved in Wisconsin or out of state need to be removed from the state's voter rolls if they don't respond to a postcard that's sent to them asking, hey, do you still live at this address? We have reason to believe you don't still live at this address. Under state law, there's a small time period in which someone needs to be removed from the voter list. The Elections Commission instead approved a period of time based on experience that they had with voter roll maintenance in the past that allowed up to 2 years for people to remain on the voter rolls if they didn't respond to that postcard. So there's been some pushback saying that they needed to follow the law. The Supreme Court arguments got pretty wonky. It came down to who actually has the power to remove people from voter rolls and who doesn't. But the bottom line is there hasn't been a ruling from the state's highest court about whether the Elections Commission broke the law or not. There was no legal requirement before the election that the Elections Commission needed to take action, or other state officials like municipal clerks, others that have a role to play in maintaining the state's voter rolls, needed to remove people from those rolls in Wisconsin.
And there was also an issue raised on that press release about indefinitely confined voters being able to request absentee ballots without voter ID. You let me know that was resolved back in, that was an issue back in the primary time?
Yes. So this is an interesting case in which Dane County Clerk Scott McDonnell and back in the spring, Milwaukee County Clerk George Christensen issued some guidance about what it means to be indefinitely confined as a voter in Wisconsin. If you mark yourself, if you identify as indefinitely confined, you don't need to meet some of the typical requirements for issuing or for receiving and casting an absentee ballot in Wisconsin. They said because of the COVID-19 pandemic, people feeling more limited about leaving their homes because of the pandemic could say that they're indefinitely confined. Republicans pushed back on that in Wisconsin and said that was too broad of an interpretation of what it means to be indefinitely confined, and that it was an attempt to get around some of those requirements for absentee voting, most particularly the state's voter ID law and the voter ID requirements for absentee voting. So in the spring, the court agreed that McDonald's guidance, that this guidance about absentee indefinitely confined voters was too broad. The clerk withdrew his guidance and has clarified it from that point forward. There's been another kind of follow-up on that to the court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court. They heard further arguments on that in September. But up until, you know, between the spring and the general election in the fall, the Wisconsin Elections Commission issued guidance to local clerks and to voters saying, this is the state law about what it means to be indefinitely confined. This is how you interpret it. And that's kind of the framework that everybody was operating under for the election, was what state law says it means to be indefinitely confined.
In our last minute or so, Laurel, what are you watching for now in this post-election period?
Well, right now, Wisconsin is in the process of doing the county canvass, which is that kind of double check of all the election results before it kind of moves through the process of things being officially certified, made in from unofficial results to official. So we're going to watch that process for that to conclude. Once that concludes, there's the potential for the Trump campaign to request a recount, which they said that they were going to do. So we'll keep an eye out and see if they do indeed do that. And if they do, it looks like we'll have another recount to report on in Wisconsin. So just kind of watching these procedural steps as they play out.
Laurel, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter. She joined us to talk about Assembly Speaker Robin Voss calling for an investigation of how last week's election was handled here in the state. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show with Kate Archer Kent. Tomorrow at 6, it's all right to cry, but why do we do it? A psychologist tells us what makes us cry and what we get out of it. That's tomorrow at 6 on The Morning Show. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we'll talk about President-elect Joe Biden's win declared this weekend in the presidential election and what we could see in the transition between administrations between now and January. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.